Our keynote this morning, Chris Kent. Now, Chris is the Assistant Governor of the Reserve Bank of Australia, responsible for financial markets. He's been in that role since 2016. And in that role, he engages with domestic and international financial markets as well as manages Australia's foreign reserves. He reports to the RBA at its monthly meeting on financial markets and also represents the RBA on the BIS Markets Committee, as well as the BIS Committee for Global Financial Stability. Chris is also the chair of the Australian Foreign Exchange Committee as well. So I can't think of too many better people to talk about everything that is going on in today's world than Chris. We're very, very lucky to have him here. Chris, thank you for coming along, and thank you for also joining us for Q&A a little bit after your opening address. I look forward to speaking to you in a short while. Welcome.
Thank you. You can hear me okay? So I'd like to thank the CBA for the opportunity to be here today and Andrew for that kind introduction. Inflation is too high in most economies. This reflects disruptions to supply coupled with strong demand. There's been an unprecedented monetary policy response in terms of the size of policy rate increases across a wide range of central banks and in a short span of time. So this first graph shows the average of policy rates across a selection of central banks covering about 70% of the global economy. If market expectations for policy rates pan out, then by the first part of next year, the average policy rate will have increased by about an amount that's comparable to the rise that we saw in the mid-2000s. But while that increase occurred over a period of 4 years, this increase has taken place in just 4 quarters. The increase in the Reserve Bank's cash rate target has also been sizable and rapid. So after we first started raising rates by 25 basis points in May, the board then raised rates by 50 basis points in each of the 4 meetings between June and September. At its October meeting, the board raised rates by 25 basis points. The board expects to increase interest rates further in the period ahead, given the need to establish a more sustainable balance between demand and supply, and in the face of a very tight labour market. While wages growth has picked up in Australia from the low levels of recent years, it remains lower than in many other advanced economies. Indeed, wages growth is well above levels consistent with inflation in a number of these economies. The size and timing of rate increases in Australia will depend on the incoming data, including the response of household spending to the tightening in financial conditions that is still working its way through the system. Rate increases will also depend on the outlook for inflation and the labour market. In my presentation today, I want to consider some issues that relate to inflationary pressures, but with a focus on the behaviour exchange rates, both real and nominal. And forgive me if you'll just indulge me for a few minutes while I talk about a bit of history, but I do think it's particularly relevant. So wages growth and inflation had been low over a number of years prior to the COVID-19 pandemic. If we look at the growth of just one measure, the wage price index shown here, annual wages growth of around 2% had become normal, while 3-4% growth was the norm in the 15 years or so prior to the end of the mining investment boom. For many years over the past decade or so, actual growth was much weaker than the bank had forecast. And the banks discussed a range of reasons for that unexpected weakness, including rising participation rates, heightened global competition, changes in bargaining arrangements, and technology advancements. But another factor that I want to focus on that contributed to the spare capacity in the labour market over that period and affected wages growth was the very long shadow cast by the end of the mining investment boom. On the back of a boom in commodity prices, mining and mining-related investment rose from about 2% of GDP prior to the boom to a peak of around 9% in 2012. So this massive expansion in productive capacity underpinned a sizable and prolonged increase in the demand for Australian labour. But once the infrastructure was in place, and coincidentally, the terms of trade also began to decline as commodity prices fell, the demand for that labour eased noticeably. The surge in demand for labour in the boom years, and then that decline thereafter, that had significant effects on wages growth and the Australian dollar, which persisted for many years after the peak in mining investment. To understand these effects, it's helpful to consider these two margins of adjustment that enabled the resource sector to attract labour in the boom years. So first and most obviously, companies in the resources sector, they offered much higher wages in Australian dollar terms than those were being offered elsewhere. And so that encouraged workers across the country to shift away from other endeavours and move into the sector. But the nominal exchange rate provided the second margin of adjustment, and it helped to contain broader inflationary pressures in the face of very strong growth in domestic demand. The appreciation of the Australian dollar over the years leading up to the peak of the mining investment boom, that pushed up the value of Australian wages in foreign currency terms. And this made conditions in non-resource firms in the traded sector more difficult, and growth in investment output, employment and wages was weak in those parts of the economy. Meanwhile, the resource firms were benefiting from sharp rises in the prices of their outputs, and they had high expectations of future profits from the new infrastructure that they were building. As such, they were willing to pay those higher wages and absorb the freed up labour from the weaker sectors. Anyway, the key point is that the adjustment in the boom years was achieved with a balance of a rise in wages in Australian dollar terms and a nominal exchange rate appreciation that pushed up wages in foreign currency terms. And we can summarise the magnitude of these two margins of adjustment by comparing the nominal trade-weighted index of the exchange rate, shown here in orange, with the real TWI based on unit labour costs, and that's shown in green. So the nominal TWI, it appreciated by about 25% over the period leading up to the peak in mining investment. The real TWI appreciated by 45%. So the difference between the two is that extra growth in Australian dollar wages relative to the growth of wages of our trading partners. Indeed, growth in Australian unit labour costs was about 2 percentage points higher on average per annum during the boom years than prior to the boom. The average growth of unit labour costs across our major trading partners by comparison was little changed over these periods. Australian inflation was also higher during the boom years than prior to the boom. The average over this period was towards the upper end of our inflation targeting range of 2 to 3%. And at times it was noticeably above 3%. So although the exchange rate dampened the effect of the terms of trade shock by lessening the need for higher wages in Australian dollar terms, the economy still felt inflationary bumps along the road. Once the terms of trade and mining investment declined and the associated labour was freed up from the resources sector, this process of adjustment then worked in reverse. The nominal exchange rate depreciation that followed, that reduced the cost of Australian labour in foreign currency terms, helping to guide labour that was now in surplus in the resources sector back into other traded sectors. The nominal TWI depreciated by 20% from the end of the boom to 2019. By itself, however, that 20% depreciation wasn't sufficient to restore competitiveness, the level of competitiveness of Australian labour to its pre-boom levels and absorb all of the economy's spare capacity. That was achieved by slower growth in the cost of Australian labour in Australian dollar terms relative to our trading partners. Indeed, there followed a long period of low wages growth in Australia. For example, annual WPI growth dropped to rates that were 1 percentage point below pre-mining boom norms. More importantly, though, for competitiveness, growth of unit labour costs dropped by a similar amount. And meanwhile, inflation, it averaged 1.9%, just under the inflation target range from the end of the mining investment boom up to the pandemic. So it took quite a few years after the mining investment had peaked for the Australian real TWI, shown here in green again, to return to be close to its pre-mining boom level. And while slower wages growth contributes only gradually to adjustments in the real exchange rate, this is not true of the nominal exchange rate, given that it can be much more flexible. And so this raises an interesting question. Why didn't the flexible exchange rate adjust in a way that facilitated a more rapid adjustment of the real exchange rate? Well, one notable feature of this episode was the depreciation in the nominal TWI didn't start in earnest till around 18 months after the peak in the terms of trade. So maybe partly this reflected expectations for the terms of trade, which for the time generally remained at elevated levels, even though actual terms of trade and commodity prices were declining. But it's also likely to have reflected the effect of very low interest rates globally, and in particular, unconventional monetary policies adopted by the major advanced economies in response to the after effects of the global financial crisis. Meanwhile, the Reserve Bank, we'd been easing monetary policy from late 2011 in response to the prevailing weaker economic conditions in Australia. However, from around 2016, the bank was balancing the case for a faster return of inflation to target by lowering the cash rate further against the medium-term risks associated with an increase in what were already very high levels of household debt. The board's decisions sought to limit the build-up of financial imbalances that can be a source of instability down the track. Over time, however, the evidence shifted. It became clearer that, even with the easing in monetary policy that had occurred, there was still spare capacity in the economy, which was weighing on wages growth and inflation. And a further easing in policy would be needed to absorb that capacity for inflation and for inflation to rise. Also, you may recall there'd been a tightening in lending standards in response to the Australian Prudential Regulation Authority's earlier tightening of macroprudential policies, lessening somewhat the concerns related to household debt. Accordingly, the cash rate was lowered further through 2019, and the Australian dollar depreciated to its lowest level in over a decade, and hence by about the time of the pandemic, Australia's pre-mining boom level of international competitiveness had been restored. So now I'll turn to more recent events. Over the course of this year, the US dollar has appreciated significantly against the currencies of both advanced and emerging economies, and you can see a selection of those here. The 12% appreciation of the US dollar in trade-weighted terms, shown in red, is consistent with the rapid rise in US interest rates relative to those of many other economies, including Australia. The depreciation of the currencies against the US dollar, that's going to add some pressure to already high rates of inflation in a wide range of advanced economies and emerging economies via a rise in the prices that they pay for imported goods and services. Now, that's because quite a lot of global trade is invoiced in US dollar terms. So that's a fairly automatic pass-through. However, leaving it at that, that's is an incomplete assessment of the effect of the Fed's tightening of monetary policy. And I think two other very important points should be made. So first, higher interest rates in the US will, in time, help to stem the growth of US demand for goods and services. The US economy accounts for around about 25% of the global economy. So an easing in demand pressures in the US will help to ease a noticeable portion of global demand. So that's the first point. Second, when most of the world's currencies depreciate against the US dollar, households and firms in those economies will not be as willing, nor will they be as able, to pay the same US dollar denominated prices for their imports. Hence, we should expect those prices to decline, or at least not rise quite as rapidly as they had been over time. And we can actually see that effect quite clearly and in very quick time, actually, with homogeneous commodities, goods like commodities that are traded on global spot markets. So just take gold and oil as examples. The daily changes in the US dollar prices of those commodities typically have a strong negative correlation with the change in the value of the US dollar, as shown here. Those yellow and black lines, most of the time, not always, but most of the time, those correlations are in the negative space. So that is, when the US dollar goes up, prices of those commodities come down somewhat on average. That's the mechanism I just mentioned. And while that response may take more time to play out in the market for goods and services that are not as homogeneous, they're not traded in global spot markets, the same sort of adjustment is still likely to occur for a broad range of traded items. Even so, for many emerging market economies, there is likely to be a sizable pass-through of the depreciation of their currencies against the US dollar into domestic inflationary pressures. So this reflects the tendency of emerging market economies to have a much larger share of traded goods in their consumption baskets compared with advanced economies. Also, inflation tends to be less well anchored in these economies. A number of economies, I'm talking both about advanced and emerging, they have experienced broad-based exchange rate depreciations. So those economies will tend to experience a more notable increase in their import prices as a result. And this is in contrast to economies whose currency depreciations have been more narrowly based. And the Australian dollar falls in that latter camp. So while it has depreciated significantly against the US dollar, and you can see that in the red line in the top panel here, falling by 14% this year, in trade-weighted terms, the black line in the top panel, the Australian dollar has depreciated by only 2% over the same period. In trade-weighted terms, the Australian dollar has moved broadly in line with its fundamental determinants. In particular, it's been underpinned in part by the elevated prices of some of our commodities. Commodity prices overall have declined over the past few months, but they remain, as you can see in the bottom panel here, the RBA index of commodity prices, they remain around the levels seen at the turn of the year. The decline in the Australian dollar over recent months also accords with the fall in the differential between interest rates in Australia and those of major economies. You can see that in the yellow line in the bottom panel. Again, much of this reflects the rapid and prospective rise in the policy rate in the US, which is larger than for the cash rate in Australia based on market expectations. The smaller depreciation of the Australian dollar in trade-weighted terms than against the US dollar, that's important because the TWI typically has a greater bearing on our imported inflation than any one bilateral rate. The bank's models suggest the depreciation will contribute to a higher level of consumer prices. Not of consumer price inflation, but a higher level of consumer prices. But the effect from the depreciation in the TWI that we've seen over the year to date of around 2%, that's estimated to be relatively modest. If we use a rough rule of thumb, and I acknowledge the uncertainty around this, but a rough rule of thumb from our models suggests that the level of the consumer price index will be higher by only around 0.2% in total over the course of a few years as a reflection of this TWI depreciation. Now, one final point I think is worth mentioning on the rapid rise in US interest rates and the appreciation of the US dollar is the potential financial effects of this on other economies. Of most concern are some emerging market economies that have elevated levels of foreign debt, denominated in foreign currency terms, and unhedged. Australia's offshore debt, though, is well hedged. And moreover, because Australian banks issuing debt offshore swap most of that back into Australian dollars, in effect, they end up paying Australian interest rates on that funding, not the higher US rates. In other words, the rise in US interest rates is not likely to have a significant effect on Australian banks' funding costs. So just draw a few conclusions together. The long shadow cast by the end of the mining investment boom contributed to many years of lower wages growth in Australia. But with Australia's real exchange rate on unit labour costs, based on unit labour costs, having returned to levels around its pre-mining boom days, that adjustment appears to have run its course. And this year, the US dollar has appreciated noticeably as the US interest rates have risen more rapidly than those in many other economies. And because much of global trade is invoiced in US dollars, this will add to the cost of imports for a time. But the rise in US interest rates will also contribute to a decline in global inflationary pressures. And while the exchange rate can play an important role in inflation outcomes, the depreciation of Australia's nominal trade-weighted exchange rate over the year to date will contribute only a very modest uplift to the level of consumer prices over the period ahead. Thank you very much for listening. I look forward to your questions. I'm in your hands, Andrew.
Thank you very much, Chris. Why don't we have a seat? Very interesting thoughts. Just housekeeping quickly, there's roving mics around the room, so to the extent you've got a question, just raise your hand and I'll do my best to navigate the order. I might just start though, and we'll come to inflation and FX in a minute, but just start with the bond market. You know, with the RBA and other central banks being such a large buyer of bonds through the pandemic, that can have the ability to be quite distortionary, you know, to the market with respect to liquidity. What would be your observations with respect to the Australian bond market and maybe the ability to release more bonds back into the market to improve liquidity? And I fully appreciate that the RBA review is still ongoing as well.
Sure. let me just start by noting that the board currently has no plans to sell bonds from our stock. Various reasons for that, but among others, I think the cash rate can do the job it needs to in terms of tightening conditions, monetary conditions. I think selling would complicate the task of issuance, not just by the OFM, but by the semis as well. I think in terms of the liquidity effects, look, we've conducted a review of internally of the bond purchase program ourselves. So that's quite detailed. That's out and published. That found no material effect. It's not to say there was no effect, but no material effect on the functioning of those markets. I think one of the reasons is that we have a stock lending facility. So we recognised, yeah, if we're holding a lot of stock and we just sit on that entirely and don't release it at all, that could be problematic for market functioning. But recognising that, we do lend those bonds out when they're needed. So I think there was a lot of demand for that around the time of the end of the yield target late last year. That's eased back a bit, but it's still out there. We're lending about $5 billion outstanding per day, something that order of magnitude. So look, liquidity's tight, but you sort of expect that. That's not just an Australian phenomenon. That's a global phenomenon. Given the uncertainties, the large moves in yields, markets are trying to find a new home, a new place for those yields, and moving a lot with news. But the market overall is functioning okay.
Excellent. Thank you. You mentioned monetary policy can probably do the trick. What's your view just on the ability for, you know, Australian households, mortgage owners, their ability to cope with the rapid increase of interest rates, the base rate and mortgage rates, in particular given they've already gone through essentially the way we assess the buffer, you know, when we're lending out to the household?
Mm-hmm. Look, I think it's clearly going to vary. You know, the effect's going to vary across the households with mortgages, and we're talking about households with mortgages, right? So we published some details in the Financial Stability Review recently. I think my assessment of that was most households will manage, but of course all of their budgets are under pressure from, one, rising rates and high rates of inflation. Many borrowers, of course, well ahead of the scheduled payments. That's a feature of Australia, but that was amped up during the pandemic when saving rates went very high, including by those with mortgages. So they're well placed to make an adjustment. Some with small or no buffers, they're going to struggle more than others. They're likely, though, our assessment is at this stage to be a small share of borrowers. The APRA's buffers were helpful, of course. You talked about those. But remember, many borrowers didn't take out the maximum loans that those buffers implied. So that's helpful as well. But look, we're going to be monitoring the effects of increased rates on household spending. And remember, we do actually want it to have an effect on household spending, to rein that in somewhat.
Yeah, and I think you'll hear from our CEO a little bit later on, and I think his view would be largely similar to yours as well. So to the extent you have questions for him later on. Just see if there's any questions around the room before I go on. There's one in the back corner here.
Hello, thank you for your presentation, Christopher. My name's Adam Lang. Turns out the mining boom was kind of handy with investment in capacity. Where would you like to see the next investment in capacity come into?
It's a good question. I understand why you're asking it, but I always feel like economists should stay well away from picking any winners, because that's the first thing they would tell you. Picking winners is not the right thing. Look, we need a broad mix of investment under the right sort of conditions, including a bit less uncertainty, would sort of help. That's a global phenomenon at the moment. Surprisingly, our liaison suggests there is not going to be a very large increase in mining investment capacity this time around, even though the terms of trade are at an even higher peak. Remember, a lot of that capacity last time was put into things like natural gas and coal. Given the need to respond to global warming, there's going to be a lot less of that. Companies have worked that out, so they're not undertaking that sort of investment. But it's not for me to sort of pick particular winners or favourites. I think the market can take care of itself. Because we need good investment in infrastructure, there's a lot of that going on. That's public infrastructure, and that should always be the case, that we need continual investment in public infrastructure, including while the population's growing, which probably start to pick up again in the period ahead.
Another question?
Thank you for the speech. It's Peter Hannon from The Guardian. Just wondered if the trade weighted index implies only modest effects for inflation, what would a debt weighted index in terms of Australian exposure, say, to US borrowings imply if the US dollar is falling? Any sort of, I guess, corporate stresses you can see coming if it suddenly gets a lot more expensive to repay in US dollars if they're not hedged? And just secondly, this broader issue, you did touch on global warming just then. We do seem to be in kind of endless flood zones up and down the East Coast, and maybe for a few more months. At what point do you think the productive capacity of Australia, particularly on the farming front, but maybe in mining and elsewhere, maybe even energy production, when will that need to be adjusted to take into account what's becoming the new reality? Thanks.
Well, I think on the question of debt, I hadn't thought to put a sort of debt base tie together. It probably would. Your sort of inclination would you think, well, we raise a lot more debt in the US, Europe, the UK, denominated in those currencies. So you might sort of think, well, it might be quite different. But I think you have to acknowledge that the vast bulk of it is hedged one way or the other, either through financial instruments, that's what the banks use when they're doing swaps, or natural hedges. So the resource companies that are actually selling commodities that are denominated in foreign currencies. So I don't think it would really make a big difference. And actually, when the Aussie dollar depreciates, that can sometimes, as you suggest, makes you think, oh, it's going to be harder to pay those US dollars back, but not because they're fully hedged. And actually, there's a flow in an accounting sense that the banks are receiving on margin payments. when the dollar depreciates. In terms of the global warming, look, I think it's hard to make aggregate statements about sort of capacity and what that should do and how it should change. I mean, Australia's gone through very long cycles of drought, fire, flood. So it's obviously incredibly painful for the farmers that are facing flood after flood in recent times down the eastern seaboard. But I'm not sure I can sort of opine too much on the sort of the longer term, broader aggregate effects of that.
Just down the front here. Yeah, so let me come down to this gentleman, then I'll come back up to that table.
Thank you for your comments. I'm Rob Robles from BCA Research. You touched on how kind of separating the interest rate decision from sort of the asset purchase decision. You think, you know, rates can meet a lot of the goals that RBA has right now for policy setting. You are hearing other central banks around the world, the Bank of England is maybe the most extreme case, but of separating that interest rate and balance sheet and asset purchase balance sheet decision in a way that's almost counterintuitive. In the past, we've seen, you know, cut rates to zero and use asset purchases to reinforce that message and markets will price in low rates for longer. Now we're hearing rate increases, but also sort of targeted asset purchases. We're seeing, you know, the Bank of England just announced they're going to be reducing their balance sheet, but do it for bonds less than 20 years maturity, knowing those long maturity bonds are the problems for their pension funds. The European Central Bank is talking about, you know, raising rates, but a purchase facility to buy Italian bonds in case things go bad in Italy. Is this credible policy to have the balance sheet policy go against what the interest rate policy is doing? Or is this the future of central banking where the balance sheet can now be used for financial stability purposes and not for rate setting purposes?
I think the starting point there is, first and foremost, financial stability is absolutely critical, because without it you can't achieve your monetary policy goals. And stop worrying about transmission if your market's truly dysfunctional and financial stability is at risk. So that's always the sort of high priority in the near term, and you can understand that's why the Bank of England came in, conducted the purchases they did in a very targeted part of the market that was most problematic. Obviously that sits a bit uncomfortable with the need to address high inflation through tighter monetary policy conditions. But, you know, I think what they've conveyed and what they've done so far has been very focused, very short term. So now they can get back on to the business, assuming the markets can be more stable now. Let's keep our fingers crossed. So far, so good. But they can get on with the business of tightening financial conditions. So maybe that tension's going to be there. But it's no good sort of worrying about the need to sort of tighten monetary policy and completely ignore those really acute episodes of dysfunction that might happen from time to time, as did in the UK gilt market over the last few weeks.
Thank you.
Let's come back up to this corner.
Hi, thanks for fielding my question. My name's Carl. I'm from AusBiz. I just had a question on credibility. Obviously, there's the discussion about the RBA's credibility with households, and there's been a very transparent review into what went wrong in terms of communication. But my question applied a little bit more to credibility in the marketplace. Obviously, there was the issues with yield curve control when that broke down, and also perhaps the RBA being caught off, or sorry, market participants being caught off guard, perhaps by the size and rapidity of the RBA's hiking cycle, that perhaps there was a miscommunication and also an issue with signalling there to market participants. I wanted to know if there was any sense that perhaps there might be a greater risk premium being baked into Australian government bonds on the basis that the RBA has lost a level of credibility in the short term. Also, whether that has an impact on the exchange rate in any sort of non-trivial way. And also perhaps as a secondary to that, whether the what's being priced into rates markets, well, this is sort of a second part of the question, but what's being priced into the rates markets at the moment is a, you know, a cash rate mixture of somewhere around 4%, seemingly following expectations of tighter Fed rate policy. Does that kind of follow the leader dynamic have any credence in terms of the way that you consider policy, or is that just markets overshooting? Thanks, Mike.
Sorry, just not quite sure that last
last part?
Pardon me. I just noticed that in terms of cash rate futures markets, we've seen a fairly significant shift in terms of the expectations for the terminal rate. Mostly it would seem based on expectations that the Fed funds rate could climb above 5%. So not so much based on Australian fundamentals, but obviously the exchange rate impacts that might have, as well as just higher global rates. Just wanted to see if there's any credence into what the markets might be pricing in, or is it just markets doing funny things?
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best to answer that. There's quite a bit in there. I think, I mean, the starting point is, yes, we acknowledge things like the way the yield target ended was costly in terms of the bank's credibility. The bond purchase program ended a lot more smoothly, and we've learned some lessons from that, comparing and contrasting the two. We're currently conducting an internal review of forward guidance, and we'll be publishing that later this year. So that'll touch on some of these elements. But just stepping back and thinking about sort of monetary policy over the course of this year, since we started raising rates in May, I mean, we haven't been alone in raising rates rapidly. We're a bit different in some ways, and you need to be a bit cautious and careful to sort of compare rate increases in any given meeting, because we meet more frequently, and the Deputy Governor, Michelle Bullock, made that very clear in her speech recently. But I think the markets have attended broadly to the notion that, yes, inflation's high here, it's not quite as high as elsewhere, but in particular, wages growth had picked up from very low levels, which is why I wanted to emphasise where we'd come from in my speech. They're picking up now from those very low levels. That's something we were actually looking for. But they're very different from, at this stage, from many advanced economies, including the US, which you flagged, which is got wages growth which is not consistent with their inflation target. It's too high and it needs to come down in nominal terms. I think markets have attended to those sort of differences across economies, and so our path for the cash rate is not as high as for some other economies, including the US, as you flagged. And as I showed in my last chart there, that interest rate differential, that's why the interest rate differentials come down. The Aussie's depreciated a bit. But I think that's all okay. The Aussie dollar is doing what it needs to do. So I think that the broad picture is well understood by markets, those differential across economies, their situations, and the Aussie dollar is just reflecting and responding to those.
Yeah, and you're one of the first central banks to slow the rate of tightening. Just recently went on Gareth and Stephen, economics team, got that right. At what point, though, does that interest rate differential become a problem for the Aussie dollar? I thought you were very articulate in the way the TWI makes a difference for Australia versus just the outright US dollar rate. But how much do you take that into consideration, and when could it be a problem if you really do think there's a big difference between, you know, the makeup of wage inflation in Australia versus the US, for example?
I don't see it as likely to be a problem. I see that interest rate differential and the response of the exchange rate is just a natural response to differences in the economy's fundamentals. And as I suggested, the Australian exchange rate, the TWI, which is the one that sort of matters for inflation, that has depreciated, but by a lot less than against the US dollar. And the level of the TWI and its moves, broadly speaking, and there's a lot of uncertainty around these models, but they're broadly in line with our fundamental determinants. Commodity prices still elevated, right, which is also one thing that sets the Australian economy sets us differently from many other economies, which are experiencing big terms of trade shocks, like in Europe, that are adverse. But the interest rate differential as well. So the TWI is sort of doing more or less what you might expect it to do, and I wouldn't think that that's a significant concern.
Okay. Any other questions from the floor? Back corner.
Morning, Chris. Lawrence Davison. I wanted to ask if the RBA's started to think differently about lagging effects. There was some research earlier this year from CBA suggesting that it might take 2 to 3 months for a rate increase to feed through to the household, even in a variable rate mortgage. And you mentioned, obviously, this is a fairly unprecedented rapidity of hikes, and we're only just starting to see at the margin things like household spending intentions coming off. I guess the sort of question within the question is whether that increases the risk of overshoot.
Well, I think you're right to highlight the importance of the fact that monetary policy operates with a lag. And I think that is the challenge that faces not just us, but other central banks when you're raising rates rapidly. And that's why I thought it was an important way to sort of just convey in that first chart just how rapid this is. You know, last time we saw a move of this much globally, 4 years it took. Four quarters this time round. So it operates with a lag, and I think that means that the tightening, as you said, and as CBA has flagged and others, the tightening's still working its way through. The tightening that up until the last rate increase at the last board, that's still going to take some months before it affects mortgage payments. Those are the natural lags. We do have a large share of variable rate mortgages, much larger than most other advanced economies. So those effects come through fairly quickly. The other thing is we had a lot of fixed rate mortgages undertaken during the pandemic, partly as in response to those low fixed rate loans that were a response in turn to our policy measures. But a lot of those were fairly short term, and they're starting to increasingly roll off over the period ahead. So you do need to think very carefully about lags, and you do need to think about monetary policy and try and look forward when setting it.
Down here in the front. Just down here. Thanks.
Good morning, Philip Brown from the CBA. Also a question on lags in a sense. I was wondering, if the pandemic hadn't happened, do you think we'd finished the shadow of the mining boom? Because we went into the pandemic with a much weaker economy, a much lower cash rate than most of the rest of the world. And on your chart, you had the TWA falling back to 100, but before the mining boom, it had spent most of those years noticeably below 100. And I ask that because how much of the stimulus applied during the pandemic actually was effectively used to mitigate that mining boom shadow, and how much of it is actual stimulus that we're now seeking to unwind?
I think that's a hard to know with any certainty, but my rough sense is that the real exchange rate, you know, it wasn't doing a lot. It moved lower, partly in response to our cuts to interest rates in 2019. And they were really designed to stimulate the economy and generate higher nominal wage growth and help bring inflation up more broadly. You know, it's very hard to speculate what might have been and what could have happened. But my sense was that there enough time had passed since that peak in mining investment for its effects and aftershocks to sort of have completely worked through the system. But the surprising thing is that wasn't a process that just took 1 or 2 years. I think it took a few more years. Would it have needed more, even more time, more than 7 years? Probably not. I really don't think so.
Adam.
Thanks, Chris, for your speech. On the wages side of things, you obviously highlighted the big adjustments that had occurred previously. Now, in this recent period, Australia has a wage growth figure that appears a bit out of kilter with, particularly with the US, but a number of other places. I guess what I'm wondering is why? Do you think there's institutional or structural factors in Australia that are keeping wages at a lower level than elsewhere and therefore sort of makes your task a bit easier than other central banks? Or is it another lag and has what we've seen in the United States and elsewhere a risk of occurring here?
Um, I think there must be, and there are some institutional factors, right? A large share of our wage setting is done on under longer term arrangements, whether there's an agreement that takes place over 2-3 years. So that just imparts some inertia. So having started very low and then starting to move up, that process tends to be a bit slower because of that. Of course, that can work the other way and make the task more difficult if wage growth get too high. Let's hope that's not on the cards. It doesn't appear likely. That's certainly not in our forecasts. And in particular, because we actually started raising rates at about the time we could see indications that wage growth was lifting off where it had been, so that was a good thing. But it certainly hadn't got out of control by any means, certainly not where wages growth was in many other countries that have a much more significant problem with wages growth in terms of nominal wage growth well above their inflation target. So we started before that became an issue. Some criticised us. We started too early. We didn't see convincing evidence from the ABS, but we were seeing it in liaison. We were seeing it everywhere that wages growth was picking up, and that's what's come to pass.
Hi there, Jonathan Shapiro from the Financial Review. I've two brief but unrelated questions. The first is on the term funding facility. There's about $200 billion of funding rolling off in the next 18 months. My question is on the Reserve Bank and what modelling or forecasting or assumptions you've made about what that might do to bank funding costs. And the second question is that we've had the large prices boom that we've experienced in the mining sector over recent years. Wondering if you think that may have skewed profit and productivity data over the past decade. Thanks.
Maybe I'll take that second one first. I mean, it did have a big effect on measures of productivity and was part of the reason why unit labour costs were doing what I suggested. When we were all spending a lot of time and effort putting that infrastructure in place across the economy leading up to the peak in the mining investment boom, that investment hadn't yet been turned on. It wasn't producing anything. So aggregate measures of productivity were growing much more slowly then. Then as the infrastructure's turned on, suddenly there's a lot of productivity and you're actually using less workers in that sector. So those sorts of big moves did have an effect on the aggregates. I'm not sure that that's sort of an enduring effect now. On the TFF, yeah, it's $188 billion outstanding. That's roughly, that's due a good tranche of it by September of next year and then the rest by June of the following year. Remember though, the banks, when they were taking it out, took it out over a period of time. They didn't come in the last day it was available and take it all in one hit. So they naturally spread some of their take up of that. And the very strong expectation, what we hear directly from banks, what APRA are talking to the banks about, is to manage this process carefully, recognising you can't raise all of the money that you need to replace that funding in one go at the last minute altogether. You've got to spread it over a period of time. So I think there's every reason to expect that they'll do that. In terms of the cost, well, we don't know quite what markets are going to be doing at that time. Still a long way out. But remember, it accounted for something in the order of about 4 or 5% of credit. So it's not a really large share of their funding. Most of the bank's funding costs, in any case, are determined by the short end of the curve, 3-6 month BBSW. Yeah.
Thanks, Chris. Aaron Jackson, Westpac Treasury. So I know one thing the RBA has referenced before is the spread between the government bond curve and the OIS curve. Obviously, that's deeply negative now, with distortions at particular points. The April 24 is sort of, you know, 60 under OIS or something at the moment. We've got, you know, no term premium in the bond market. The ASX has recently had to take actions to increase liquidity in the futures market. Are these sort of things that you're concerned with at the moment, or how are you sort of thinking about them?
Not particularly. As I said at the outset to Andrew, I think our overall assessment is liquidity globally in bond markets is a bit less than it had been, to varying degrees across economies. That's natural in a time of considerable uncertainty about the macro outlook. But I don't think it's having a sort of materially adverse effect on how our market's functioning. I think our market's functioning well enough, all things considered. Some of the things you point to, I mean, some of those yields on some securities at the shorter end of the curve being in a bit lower than OIS, that may just be because there are certain buyers that want to hold, that have mandates to only hold those sorts of instruments for liquidity purposes. They're in high demand, relatively short supply, partly because we bought quite a few of them. But we're lending our stock out to help trading in those markets. So I think they're functioning well enough to not be of a significant concern.
We've got time for one more question, if there is one. There we go. Back right corner.
Thank you. So, Assistant Governor, a lot of economists and financial commentators reckon major economies like the US, UK, Europe are heading towards recession, and China's economy isn't doing too great either. There's a massive slowdown happening there. So, in that context, how worried about are you that Australia's economy might not achieve a soft landing, given the path is already quite a narrow one?
Oh, you almost answered the question for me, but I mean, you're right. Europe is in a very difficult position. They've been very hard hit by not just energy prices, but also the availability of that energy and facing potential rationing. The US had very rapid interest rate increases, dealing with very high inflation and very high nominal wage growth. China, yep, zero COVID. That's a significant headwind, but their property market's facing very significant headwinds as well, and we've talked about those in the past. It's worth remembering, though, and I had a sense of this in my speech, that slower demand overseas, that helps bring global inflationary pressures down, and those are not the only reason for our high inflation, but they're an important part of it. So that's a helpful aspect. What about us? Well, we're not so affected by energy in quite the same way. And for much of our economy, of course, it represents a positive thing because we produce a lot of energy and export it. So it's a positive terms of trade shock. Europe, it's a negative. We've got lower wages growth, but the labour market is very tight and we need to address the implications of that. Growth still strong. Could it slow? Will it slow? Probably. That's partly what monetary policy is seeking to achieve. And it is having its effect. But as you say, we don't expect a recession. There's lots of uncertainties. There always are, but especially now. And inflation needs to come down. So it's a very narrow path, as you described.
Economies like the US, UK, Europe, probably heading into a recession, but we'll be okay. They're going to recession, but not us.
No, those are your words. I think I
answered
the best.
I mean, that's how I'm interpreting.
Those are your words. I think it's a narrow path is a useful description.
All right.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, Chris, thank you very much for coming along today. We greatly appreciate your insights, but also your honesty and transparency and the way you answered the questions. We're in your hands collectively. We wish you all the best navigating a complicated set of circumstances. Please join me in thanking Chris Kent.
Thank you. Thanks, all. Cheers.
Thank you very much.
Thanks. That was really good.
And we're going to go to a 15-minute break, and then we're going to be back in this room after the break. Thank you.